If you'd like to listen to the Daily Blast, plus all of our other DSR content without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, and enhanced show notes for select shows. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code GREG to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code GREG. Thank you very much for your support.
This is the Daily Blast from the New Republic, produced and presented by the DSR Network. I'm your host, Greg Sargent. This week, a Politico report ripped the lid off of deep tensions that have been simmering for some time now between the New York Times and the White House. President Biden's advisors see the paper of record as arrogant and unwilling to give Biden a fair shake. The Times responds that Team Biden unreasonably wants to control coverage of the president. We think this debate is badly in need of some major clarifications. The Times is doing some great and revelatory work covering this election, particularly the threat of Donald Trump, but at the same time, a fair amount of the criticism of the Times is reasonable and correct, gets at some important journalistic issues, and is often misunderstood, not least of all by some people at the Times itself. To discuss this, we've invited Brian Beutler back on the show. Beutler's Substack, Off Message, offers some of the best criticism of political media that's out there today. Welcome back, Brian.
It's great to be back with you.
So the Politico piece by Eli Stokols portrays something like a secret shadow war going on between the Times and the Biden camps, both the White House and the campaign, a situation that is, quote, remarkably tense and beset by misunderstandings, grudges, and a general lack of trust. Let's first deal with the big quote in the piece that's getting all the attention. A Times staffer suggests that publisher A.G. Sulzberger is quietly encouraging negative coverage of Biden's age, in part out of pique that the paper isn't getting an interview, a sit-down interview with the president. I'm a bit skeptical of this, and I want to hear your thoughts on it, Brian. It's a blind quote. It's not clear how that would actually work. Would the publisher do that? Even if he did, would that actually dictate editorial choices? What do you think?
Well, it wouldn't work the way we see things working at Fox News, right? Like Fox News will kind of like on a regular basis libel somebody, they'll go to court, there'll be discovery, and then emails will leak showing that basically the way the company works is very top down and like orders come down from on high to cover Democrats in a certain negative light or make certain claims that are false or highly tendentious. And I don't think it's credible to argue that this quote suggests that the New York Times works like that. But I do think that like the ownership structure and the beliefs of the owner of any organization, any, you know, profit-making organization are going to matter as to like the conduct of the people who work beneath that person. And if it's widely understood that the boss is frustrated with Joe Biden and wants to use the paper's clout to sort of leverage impel Biden to do this interview that Sulzberger reportedly wants him to do, then that will have an effect just on how people like go about their jobs and try to survive within the institution or climb the ranks within the institution. So I can't imagine it has no effect either, right? Part of the reason I feel like maybe I lend the story a bit more credibility than you do is that Politico and the Times, like Politico is a feeder to the New York Times. They're well-sourced at the New York Times, right? Like the papers kind of have a bit of a symbiosis, at least Politico and the New York Times political desk. And it would be like it strains credulity to me that would be a baseless blind quote from somebody who wasn't in the know, right? Like those two outlets really do have a lot of cross-pollinization.
I'll give you some of that there, yeah, right? It's hard to imagine that Politico, which is, as you say, very plugged into the DC media, would just sort of throw something out there without sort of having at least a fair amount of confidence that it reflected a real thing, but who knows. But I want to get past the gossipy stuff in the piece, because to me it's sort of secondary to the Biden camp's overarching complaint about the Times, which is that the Times' search for the appearance of objectivity ends up blurring the asymmetries, as Politico puts it, between Trump and Biden when it comes to their core commitments to democratic principles. That's something you and I and many others have also pointed out regularly, not just about the Times, about the whole political media, really. And I think there's no doubt that this happens on a fairly regular basis. And so I'm a bit surprised to see this treated as almost a scandalous thing by the New York Times reporters who responded in the piece. We all know this is a problem. It's right out there for everybody to see. It's not, there's not really any doubt that it's a problem, is there?
No, I mean, like, as you say, this is not the White House freelancing as media critics, right? Like, this is a well-developed, lengthily articulated line of criticism about the way the New York Times politics desk covers politics specifically, and how mainstream political news tends to cover campaigns in general, right? Like, The Biden White House and the Biden campaign didn't invent this line of criticism. They are feeding off of the work of, like, not just you and me, but actually respectable people, right? Like Margaret Sullivan and James Fallows and Jay Rosen, right? Like, there's a big body of work about this, going back many, many, many years now. But you know, I am not surprised at all to see the New York Times top brass take the White House making this criticism and rolling their eyes at it the way they have when the rest of us have made the same criticism, right? Like to, you know, it goes back to before the 2016 campaign, but to me, the 26 campaign coverage was so obviously egregious and the criticism of it so, like, well-documented and, you know, offered, I think, in the spirit of good faith and hoping to see that, like, the mainstream political news in general, but the Times in particular, reflect and maybe change their approach, at least as long as we're in this sort of Trumpian era of informational warfare, right? And like the brass has never done it, right? There have been maybe a couple examples. I can think of actually one off the top of my head. Was, I think, Amy Chozick was the Times reporter who was assigned to the Hillary Clinton campaign, who later wrote a book. And in her book, she expresses some misgivings and even essentially some feelings of guilt, I think, about how she got swept up in the email feeding frenzy and the desire to create a balance between Trump and Clinton and how that distorted public perception of the two candidates. Well, but, you know, the editors of the New York Times have never accepted that criticism. And so they've never really changed their approach. And so when they now hear the same criticism coming from the White House, it just reaffirms to them that this is something, you know, grubby partisans say and actually something worth taking seriously. So yeah, I would have been more surprised if the White House had come to them and said, hey, the way you're covering the news is distorting important differences between Biden and Trump. And they said, oh, you know what? You're right. Maybe we should get a handle on that. Right. Like, we've been trying to get them to get a handle on that for a decade now, and like to little effect.
And there really is, as you kind of get at, a kind of paint by numbers quality to the response, right? There really is a kind of weirdly reflexive dismissiveness that you often hear. You see it on Twitter from star reporters at the Times, sometimes from editors. And it's puzzling because they don't need to adopt that tone with these criticisms. I have no earthly idea how New York Times editors can look at that now infamous front page, I guess around 11 days before the 2016 election, which was just absolutely plastered by the email story because of the new revelations from James Comey, how they can possibly look at that and defend it now and not see a problem. But let's get to some specifics here. One of the Times reporters quoted by Politico said this about the Biden criticism, quote, "They're not being realistic about what we do for a living. You can be a force for democracy, liberal democracy. You don't have to be a force for the Biden White House," close quote. Now, this immediately commits a serious fallacy. It equates the demand for clarity about the true nature of the differences between Trump and Biden on one side with a demand for special treatment for Biden on the other. And that's completely unresponsive, right? The threshold question is this: does the Times regularly make editorial choices that obscure the distinctions between the two when it comes to matters of fundamental importance? For instance, that Trump poses a unique threat to the system itself and Biden just does not. Let me ask you, is that a legit formulation of the threshold question? And does a casual Times reader come away with that appreciation or not? What's the answer to that?
I think probably not, but like it's, you know, the truth is that like a typical Times reader also probably gets media from elsewhere, right? Like there's been all these interesting studies about where do liberals versus conservatives get their news, and the Times is a big source of news, but people who read the Times also get their information from other relatively credible sources of information, whereas Republicans really are stuck in a Fox News-esque bubble. So I think that the, like, just taking it at face value, the New York Times can be on the side of liberal democracy. It doesn't mean they have to be on the side of the Biden White House is unobjectionable, but that's why it's raised as a response to the criticisms that the White House and the campaign are leveling, right?
Right.
The campaign and the White House are asking them to do the first thing. They're not saying kiss up to us or tell people to vote for us or bury bad news about us or lie about Donald Trump, right? They're saying endeavor to make the important differences that we're all aware of clear to your readers through your headlines, through your story placement, through how you assign stories and how much space and paper you give to them.
I think we should acknowledge that the Times is doing a ton of great work that actually does detail Trump's authoritarian plans for a second term with extraordinary professionalism and revelatory power, right? You get the pieces on the vows to gut the bureaucracy and stock it with loyalists, the threats to turn the Justice Department loose on Trump's enemies, the plans for giant deportation camps and so forth, all in the Times, right? So they have a fair response. But I think what you and I would respond, and I think what the Biden campaign maybe would respond, I'm not sure. I think they think this. I don't know. But the day-to-day editorial choices when it comes to headlines and how to position the Trump campaign's response to this or that versus the Biden campaign's claims, that's where the rubber really meets the road on what the casual reader comes away from all this with, right? And Would they deny that there's a genuine debate to be had here about whether the conventions of political reporting, which require even-handed treatments of subjects, are in some sense not up to the task of covering a candidate and a movement who are threatening the system itself? Would they deny that? I don't think they would if you were sitting down with them.
I think it would depend on the context, right? Like, I don't think that they would say anything public that carried the implication that the way the Times approaches coverage of politics is not up to the moment, right? Like that would be a very damaging admission. And the Times as an institution is pretty averse to acknowledging anything that suggests awareness of internal shortcomings.
But right? Brian, and that is where the rubber meets the road, right? Like in that.
Well, yes, but like, so to your point about the Times doing a lot of great work, absolutely true. It's a huge institution. It's got tons of resources. I think its best work is outside of political coverage, but there is good work at the politics desk. The issue is that when you raise any kind of systemic critique like you're doing now, what the Times reporters and the editors will do is point to specific examples of the good work they've done on Donald Trump, like Project 2025 coverage and things like that. And that's definitely, like, those stories have been good. But news coverage is more than just the sum of individual stories, right? Like, it's not, a newspaper is not like an episode of a sitcom from the 1980s where there's an episode, it's 30 minutes long, and then the next episode can be about something totally different, and there's no continuity between the two, and nobody cares because you're just there for the laughs, right? That's not the model, right? The model is you're doing a bunch of discrete stories, but there's connective tissue between them, and they tell a sort of super story in many cases about the subjects of your coverage, right? And so that's why the email story was so damning to Clinton. If you brought up that the way they were covering the email scandal was totally out of proportion to the significance of the story, they'd say, well, we covered the Trump University scandal and the this and the that and the other thing. And it's like, yes, you did, but you covered it kind of in that artificial sitcom way where it was like, here's a story on this and here's a story on that, and not like Trump campaign rocked by yet another corruption scandal, right? To where it's like the story of the Trump campaign is one of these endless corruption scandals that have the campaign reeling. And I feel like they've never really covered Trump that way. They've covered Trump in a way where they kind of marvel at how impervious he is to consequences for doing anything wrong. I think that with their current methods and with their current professional ethos, like they could make changes totally consistent with professional culture, their internal professional culture, that would make big improvements in the coverage that you and I would notice and remark upon and be satisfied by.
I want to underscore what you're saying in another way though, Brian, for a second, right? Because so would your point basically is that they would not publicly acknowledge that there's some sort of institutional problem. But the thing is, I agree that they wouldn't. But the thing is, this is a problem that's larger than the Times, and it's hard for me to believe that professional journalists wouldn't simply admit that it's an issue, right? I mean, look, there's a genuine debate to be had here about whether the current conventions of political reporting are up to covering a systemic threat like Trump and MAGA, the movement, right? Would Times editors or editors at other big institutions really assert that they've got that figured out? That their day-to-day that their day-to-day coverage has aced that problem? I mean,
it's not either like we've aced it or we're totally out to sea and we have no idea what to do, right? Like when asked, people like Dean Baquet and other like big media luminaries will acknowledge that there are challenges and blah, blah, blah. But we think that we're we did the best under difficult circumstances. And, you know, they have a good politic way of defending the work that they've done, even when it's under withering criticism, right? To me, the tell about the mismatch between how these institutions describe the quality of the work they've done and do, the kind of criticisms that people like you and me level are pretty manifest when, you know, every few months, it seems, or maybe a couple times a year, a beat reporter from a big mainstream outlet will retire and come out and say, yeah, the way we do things is totally screwy.
Yeah.
And it like privileges in some sense, whichever party is more willing to lie and bully us. And then those people often go on to become like stalwart media critics. And
very true.
To me, that's like very telling thing that happens over and over again. Meanwhile, the people who are in the industry and still running these organizations remain hostile to to people who make the criticisms, but then B, to people who internalize the criticisms and they adopt new approaches to interfacing with media and trying to connect to people who consume media, right?
I think it would be helpful to go over a few more specifics. I mean, you've got guys like press critics like Dan Frumkin, Jameson Foser, and Mark Jacob kind of flagging a lot of these things fairly regularly. But you know, recently there was a Times piece about voter perceptions, and it said something like, each side sees the other as a threat to democracy. And the facts were in there about the threat Trump poses, but the overall effect was a kind of shrug. You know, there are different realities, who's to say? Or, you know, there's like, there was a recent Times headline that said, inside Trump's complicated relationship with law enforcement. Now, so his relationship with law enforcement is that he treats it as entirely illegitimate if it's enforcing the law against him and his allies, and he treats it as a political weapon to use against his enemies. That's not complicated, right? You can't just do a sort of Timesian raise of the eyebrow to kind of capture how deeply abnormal that is. Or take this, for example. You know I go on about this constantly, but the Times and others often say something like, this or that event gives the Trump campaign ammunition or fodder to make a political attack on Biden. And that might be effective. This becomes the hook to treat the attack itself as news, right? And elevate it. We saw that with the recent special counsel Robert Hur report that inserted the asides about Biden's age and so forth. Now, no one would deny Biden's age is a problem or a legitimate story. The point, rather, I think, is that the Times is making the editorial choice to opine or even just speculate about the possible efficacy of a Republican political attack, which then gives it more headlines. And then the concentration of those headlines, because it's the Times, sends a message to countless smaller news organizations about what's important, what they should be talking about.
There are better ways to convey the, like, you know, the nub of the kinds of stories that you were just talking about, right? Like if they brought somebody from one of their international desks who had covered Orban's Hungary or whatever to write a story about what life in America would look like if Trump succeeded in turning law enforcement into a political arm of his White House and campaign, like that would be eye-opening, even if the headline was a little bit soft touch, right? Instead, they have political reporters write these stories with sort of like you say, like a raised eyebrow at whether like this is hypocritical or ethical, but without like kind of weaving it into the larger story they should be telling about what the stakes of the election are. There's been reporting about how little the public is like knows about things like what was in the Inflation Reduction Act. And I want to say two things about that. One is that the fact that the public is unaware, I don't think it can be laid as cleanly at the feet of the mainstream media today as a decade ago, right? Like there's just like mainstream media shrinking. Propaganda media is exploding. Like just non-political media is crowding out like real news. And so I just think that like the percentage of information that people are getting that is like actually from professional news organizations has shrunk. And so of course there's going to be like an associated drop off in like public knowledge as a result of that. But it doesn't mean that outlets like the Times shouldn't view findings like that as a challenge, right? Like maybe we can't make 100% of people aware of what's important in this election, like what the stakes of it are, what life will look like if one guy wins versus the other. But we can do better than this, right? Like even if we can't get to 50%, we can certainly do better than what, like 10 or 20%. And our efforts should be geared towards making sure that kind of thing is clear. And the methods they use that you described when you asked this question, like cut against that. They're antithetical. They make it harder for people to know what Biden has done versus what Trump did and thus what life will look like in America depending on who wins. And that's a shame.
Democratic polling that I recently reported on found very low awareness of 10 of Trump's most explicit authoritarian statements. Very low awareness. And so David Roberts said something like, if I saw this and I were an editor, I'd assign a team of reporters to figure out why this is happening and I'd try to fix it. Right. As you say, it should be a challenge that the Times and other news organizations take on and assume for it themselves. I think a couple more examples, if I could. Your Orban point is really interesting about assigning a reporter who knows what happens in places like Orban's Hungary to cover what would happen if Trump got his way, modeling his approach on Orban and other autocrats, right? There was a piece recently where the Times described Trump's quote-unquote dark vision, but they were just referring to Trump's depiction of the country as a hellscape under Biden, with no serious clarity offered on the long history of this kind of use of language by semi-fascist leaders, to coin a phrase, to lay the groundwork for authoritarian rule. Or Trump regularly seems to be calling openly for delays of his trials. And the Times will report on this in a weirdly bloodless and neutral way, even though we all know that Trump is delaying them so that he can cancel prosecutions of himself if he wins. Yet the Times covers that as if it's just another legal strategy and not something highly abnormal and deeply hostile to the rule of law itself. Now, here's my question for you, Brian. I'm not sure how neutral political reporting should treat these kinds of things. It's a tough problem, right? But the point is, the Times hasn't solved it. Nobody has. Yet you get the sense that they won't even concede that.
Yeah. So they do this two-step where they'll say, democracy dies in darkness. A free press is essential to an informed citizenry, and affronts to a free press are thus affronts to democracy in some sense. But then separately, they will disavow any responsibility when the citizenry is uninformed, right? Like when the citizenry doesn't know like what Joe Biden has accomplished as president, or doesn't understand like that Trump's authoritarian threats have become explicit, and they will have like profound effects on public life in the United States if he wins. And so, yeah, you're right. Like nobody's cracked the code, but I think, and like, there's no perfect way to do it, but you can't really get there until you end the two-step, right? Like at some point they have to decide whether a press actually does and should create an informed citizenry. Or if really all this stuff, public opinion and public awareness and issue polling, et cetera, is just purely for people who work in professional politics, and all you do is you report on how they affect public opinion over time. I got to think that, they're proud enough of their work and maybe morally vain enough people that they would say, no, like we can't just be in the business of commenting on how effective various political actors are at moving the needle of public opinion or changing public awareness of things. Like we should be major agents in that process. We should be in the process of informing people, not just commenting on whether they are informed or not. If you accept that, then you have to do things differently, right? And like, you don't report on Donald Trump's efforts to delay his trial so that he can cancel his prosecutions if he wins as like a will he or won't he succeed tactical thing, yeah. but as a genuinely aberrant, unethical,
malignant
strategy that's incompatible with the rule of law, and you don't need to have people who cover campaigns write that story. They have excellent legal journalists at the New York Times, and you don't necessarily have to bring them in to write one story and then they peace out and cover the Supreme Court again or whatever. Like the fact that Trump is trying to engage in a cover-up of evidence in his January 6th trial before the election could be the same, like could generate the same kind of drumbeat coverage that the Times applied to the Clinton email scandal. Like what is he hiding? What does a grand jury have that we don't know? And get at that so that Trump can't engage in the cover-up that he's trying to engage in. And like, none of that means to like go back to where this started, that the Times has to be an arm of the Biden campaign or helping Biden win, right? Like it is, I think, totally valid and nonpartisan to say that the Republican Party has radicalized against democracy and that the agenda that it's putting forward would make the United States a less small D democratic country, like we've seen in places like Hungary and Turkey and Poland and so on. You know, they don't have to say, and that's bad, and therefore you should vote for Joe Biden. Just like let the facts kind of speak for themselves. But you have to take step one seriously, which is like, we are actually here to create an informed citizenry. And when we see that what people believe is at odds with what we as reporters know to be true because we're immersed in it every day, then that should function the way an assignment editor functions. And it should really change the way editors approach their jobs and reporters approach their jobs.
I think what you're getting at here is institutional confusion, right? What we need is a big discussion about whether the press sees itself institutionally as obligated to inform the citizenry as part of its institutional role in a liberal democracy, right? And so you've probably seen this, but I think it was Mark Jacob, the press critic, who pointed out how
former reporter, guys I was talking about.
Key point, yeah. And so one of the snarkier reporters around town dissed him publicly and essentially pointed out or said that it was kind of foolish to expect the press to play that role. And so what I wondered when I saw that was, okay, well, presumably professional reporters go into this business with a set of ideals about informing the public. Why would you suddenly decide that your profession doesn't actually have a substantial role in doing that after all? What are we doing there, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what happens, because I've seen this happen a number of times, I do think that most journalists get into journalism for some idealized reason. There are some who get into it because they think that they'll end up on TV a lot and sort of rich and famous and part of the top echelon elite or whatever. But mostly it's like people who think that reporting matters, or maybe they have fantasies about taking down a president the way Woodward and Bernstein did. But that at least, you know, that's a valid reason to want to get into this line of work. But then what happens is you join an institution and the institution is imperfect. In some instances, it's deeply imperfect. And then it comes in for criticism. And then the question is that institution receptive to criticism? And I think mainstream political media as a broad, as a super institution is not very responsive to criticism. And the New York Times in particular is hostile to it. Like there's a, like the reporters and the editors will rally around each other when they come in for this kind of criticism. And that can create a tension, an unresolvable one, between the ideals that drove those people to become journalists in the first place and their imperatives they see now that they're in it and that they've made it and that they've you're a journalist at the New York Times. Like that's like, you know, being an honors graduate at Harvard or something like that. You know, like who's anyone to take away from us or criticize us for what we've accomplished? And that's a really unfortunate dynamic. It's also sadly pretty prevalent. And I just, you know, I would like, and I do encourage people who are reporters, political writers of any kind, like if they find that public opinion is just totally adrift from what's true, from what's, you know, in the pages of the New York Times, or from at least what's in the reporters' heads, like what they happen to know to be the truth, that's prima facie evidence of some kind of shortcoming. And it's not like, and thus you're a failure, or thus like you have no redeeming quality. It just means like, it's time to retool a little bit. It's time to like rethink why we're doing this or whether we're doing it well. If at the top there is no concern for this question of whether the citizenry is in fact informed, then they're just going to view that, come to view that as not really part of their job. But it has to be for any of this to matter.
Well, I'm hoping what you said earlier today is right, and this Politico report really captured almost a threshold moment in frustration with how the press is doing things, and hopefully that could prompt the kind of conversation you're talking about. One can hope, anyway. Brian Beutler, it's always so much fun to talk to you, man.
It's great to be back.
Folks, make sure to check out a new piece we have up at TNR.com. It's by Obtin Haydari, who survived the white supremacist terror attack in Charlottesville and is now writing about the grotesque slander of comparing Gaza protesters to neo-Nazis. You've been listening to The Daily Blast with me, your host, Greg Sargent. The Daily Blast is a New Republic podcast and is produced by Riley Fessler and the DSR Network.